This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Any questions about the meditation instructions before we get into the discussion part? Well, the discussion is about the meditation instructions, so if you have a question during the talk, you can stop me and let me know. What I wanted to talk about tonight is mindfulness itself, specifically the four foundations of mindfulness. The Satipatthana is the teaching, is the name of the teaching in Pali that the Buddha originally gave, and it's hard to tell, but it seems like it's maybe the most common meditation instruction that the Buddha gave during his life. And the meditation practice that he most commonly encouraged people to apply if they were interested in happiness, in freedom, in transformation. It is the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness, or wise attention. And it's the core of our Buddhist training, of the meditation practices. It is certainly a prescription for a formal sit-down. Close your eyes, pay attention, train your mind in this formal sitting meditation way. And I'll go through the four foundations in a moment. But it's also much more than just how to sit and meditate. It's how to train our minds to bring a meditative awareness into every aspect of our life. Not just sitting. The first foundation of mindfulness is mostly what we focused on tonight. Bring attention to your breath, to your body, to the present time experience of experiencing, of feeling, of being in, of being a body. So in the meditation, first sit down, close your eyes, feel your breath, let go of the thoughts of the future and the past. Bring full attention to present time experience of the sensations of breath. But then it goes on in the first foundation to say, now when you're walking, do the same thing. When you're sitting, bring full awareness to the present time experience of your body. When you're walking, do the same thing. Bring full awareness to the present time experience of your body in action. And motion. When you're eating, being full present time awareness to the experience of eating, of chewing, of savoring, of swallowing, of digesting. And then when you're finished eating and you're finished digesting, bring full present time awareness to shitting. To your experience on the toilet or in the bushes or wherever you are. Mindfulness of the experience of the body. Every aspect of the body, there's nothing left out of mindfulness, of the four foundations. Sex, be mindful. Driving, be mindful. Working, be mindful. Eating. Maybe the only thing that we have some challenge in bringing mindfulness is sleeping. That might be your only break. Although if you ask some of the Tibetan later developments, they'll say, no, you can bring mindfulness to your dreams, dream yoga. You don't even get a break when you're sleeping. More effort. every aspect of our being, present time awareness. Awareness of what? Awareness that this body is simply the four elements. Now this is important, right? On some level that's simple. Oh yeah, there's just the earth, air, fire, water, earth, wind, and fire. Something. But I believe that part of why the Buddha is asking us to really pay close attention to these four elements, because it is really all there is. But doesn't it feel like there's something going on here in us that's not just the four elements? Part of what the Buddha is pointing towards us in mindfulness of the four elements is that you're not going to find this self that we're so attached to. Is yourself the earth element? Is yourself the air element, the temperature, the fire, or the water? Which one? If you have to choose one to be you, which element are you? You start to see all this body is these four elements. There is no solid, separate. It's all these connected arisal of the four elements. And then the 32 parts. There's hair, there's skin, there's nails, there's teeth, there's lungs, there's heart, there's intestines, spleen, the organs, there's bones, there's tissue, there's urine, there's feces, there's bile, there's spittle, there's pus. There's all of these probably foul smelling and tasting fluids. But where's the self in there? Which part of those are you? Which of those parts is you? So in the mindfulness, the Buddha, at one point he's saying, you know, unpack the body the way a skilled butcher would unpack a cow. Seeing that it's all of these parts, that you peel back the skin. Sift through your body as though you are sifting through a bag of beans, he says. Separating the different kinds of grains and beans. And seeing that there's just all of these different parts. That this body is just a sack of beans and parts. That we take to be solid, that we take to be continuous, that we take to be who we are. He's saying just pay a little closer attention. You think you're this body? Which part of this body? All of it? Some of it? Then the example says, like, okay, well, what if you lose an arm? Are you still you? How about if you lose both arms and both legs? You still you? At what point, how much of your body do you have to lose to not be you anymore? Or is it the mind that we're more identified with? Can you be you as long as you have a brain? Now, in this investigation of the body and the kind of pulling the ground out from under us as far as something to identify with, the Buddha is not saying that there is no self. He is acknowledging for sure that there is a self. But in the mindfulness, it becomes more and more clear that the self is created by all four elements, by all 32 parts, and by consciousness and memory, perception, form and feeling. The self arises out of all of these conditions coming together. And then it's somewhat real. It's not an illusion. It's a real experience. We all have the feeling of I, me, and mine. But a huge part of mindfulness is trying to break our misidentification with that feeling as being permanent who we are. Mindfulness, a huge part of the goal, as the Buddha says, you know, in meditation, in this path, nothing is worth clinging to as I, me, or mine. Now, it doesn't mean you can't feel the experience of I, me, or mine. Just don't cling to it. Don't get hooked. Don't get addicted. Because as soon as we cling to it, the sense of self is constantly changing. The I is an unfolding process. Do you know that about yourself? I am an unfolding process. That's the only real truth we can say about ourselves. Not I'm the body, or I'm the brain, or I'm the... We can just say, I'm this impermanent, unfolding, coming together of these four elements, these 32 parts, consciousness, feeling, form, perception, memory. Contingent upon each other creates a self, and then you're you, I'm me. The self isn't an illusion. Permanent self is a delusion. That feeling that we have of like that you're the same person that remembers being a little kid, and it feels like there's this constant, I have always been me, that isn't a delusion. That is a trick of the brain. That's not paying close enough attention to see that I have always been changing. There's no solid, separate, continuous anything in our experience. Mindfulness wants us to see this. This is a huge part of the goal of paying attention to the present moment in service of seeing the lack of solidity, the lack of a solid, separate, continuous, autonomous self. So we pay attention to the breath, to the body, the four elements of the 32 parts. The one part that I left out in the first foundation of mindfulness, just because it feels like it merits its own meditation practice rather than just being thrown in here. With each aspect of mindfulness, the Buddha turns us towards paying attention to impermanence, the arising and passing of the sensations of the breath, the arising and passing of the sounds, of the smells, of the tastes, of the sights, the impermanent, transient nature of all conditioned phenomena. Everything is constantly changing. And then he takes it to the level of, and remember that your body itself is impermanent, subject to sickness, old age, and death. And so in the first foundation of mindfulness, he directs us towards visualizing a corpse and the many stages of decay and acknowledging that that is the destination of this body. Visualizing a dead person. Now, sometimes we do it as ourselves, but in the traditional teaching, it's not you. It's in the context of ancient India where there's dead people laying around. And it's a very common experience to walk past the funeral grounds, what they call the charnel grounds, and to see dead bodies. And so at the time he was saying, you know, just like you would see a dead body, for us, it's a little bit of a more challenging practice to actually visualize it, because many people have never seen a dead body, or those dead bodies that we've seen are freshly dead, or dead with all of the makeup of the open casket. Because he says, you know, now imagine you see that body and all of the skin has rotten off and the flesh and the water element has left that body. And there's only earth element left. It's just bones. And then that the bones have been torn apart by the funeral, charnel ground dogs and birds. Most of us don't have the anything to refer to. Unless you've been to India and you hung out in the Ghats near the Ganges somewhere, or Nepal, and you've seen the funeral pyres. But this is a serious and often missed practice. To acknowledge on a daily basis, after, you know, kind of on some level, right after you establish mindfulness of your breath, establish mindfulness of your death, of the impermanent nature, of the definite destination of this physical body to rot and decay. Of course, we know that modern technology has been able to slow impermanence down a bit. They can embalm the body and put it in an airtight casket, and then it's going to slow down the process for, what, a couple hundred years? I don't know how long. 200, 500? How long do the bodies last when they're in the airtight casket? Hopefully long enough for... what's it called? Not Armageddon. For the rapture. Right? That we just need the bodies to last until the rapture. So that they're in good shape when they're called. Right? So they can walk out of the earth and join their creator. This is maybe a little bit more of a Hindu story, but my father was talking about, you know, working with death and dying, and had somebody asked his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, Maharaji, Ram Dass's guru, you know, what's the best thing to do when you die, what's the best thing to do? And he said, burn the body as soon as possible so that the being loses its identification with the body. If you just bury it, then the spirit being, whatever, might hang around for a while. But if you burn it, then there's just nothing to attach to anymore for that spirit, whatever it is. That's not really a Buddhist story. But. So in that first foundation of mindfulness of the impermanence of death, and not in a morose way, although the descriptions that the Buddha gives are really gross. See the pus, see the, you know, birds eating your eyeballs. But it's not to be gross. It's to bring preciousness to life. Through reflecting on the on death, to bring appreciation to the next breath. Still get to experience this living corpse, this aliveness of preciousness and opportunity, and uncertainty. We have no idea how long we've got in these bodies. It's completely uncertain how long we're going to live. What we know for sure is that we will die. Some of us will die really soon. Some of us will live for a long time. But we will all die. And so then it puts this sort of uncertainty and hopefully a little bit of a flame under our ass. Make sure you're living in a wise way. All of the first foundation, right, there's the breaking identification with self, there's the seeing impermanence really clearly. You can only do this if we pay attention. The second foundation, I believe, is where the most practical transformation in our day-to-day lives and in our level of happiness and contentment takes place. The greatest transformation takes place on our relationship to pleasure, pain, and neutrality. The second truth of the Buddha. Suffering is caused primarily by our craving, by our clinging, and our attachment to pleasure. And its flip side, which is our aversion, hatred, and denial of pain. In one way, all of the first foundation is just about getting our attention. Hey, you know, really pay attention to the body, to what in the body? The pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience of every sound, of every sight, of every smell, of every moment. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And how are we relating to that? If we are relating to pain in the habitual reactive tendency, which is we hate pain. Pain, get rid of it. Push it away. Suppress it, avoid it, medicate it. Do something to destroy it. And this causes a whole layer of dukkha, suffering, on top of unpleasant sensation in the body. Unpleasant emotion, unpleasant sense door activity. Then we turn pain into suffering. But from this perspective, pain and suffering are distinctly different experiences. Pain does not have to be a problem. When we can learn to meet pain with compassion, no suffering. Mindfulness gives us the opportunity to meet pain with compassion. According to the Buddha's 12 links of dependent origination, if we're not being mindful at the moment that our body, mind comes into contact with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we will instantly react. The body and mind, the untrained, unmindful human experience is to instantly meet pain with aversion, is to instantly meet pleasure with clinging and attachment. So it's only through mindfulness that we actually have the ability to respond rather than react. I mean, the connotations of this are huge to me. I hear this teaching and experience this teaching as the kind of quintessential free will. We go around thinking, oh no, I have free will. I choose what I do. Are you choosing whether you're happy or unhappy? If you could just choose to be happy, right, you would just choose to meet all of your pain with compassion all of the time. You would just choose to meet all of the pleasure in your life with appreciative non-attachment, non-clinging. Let go. We can't just make that choice. You don't have the free will to just do that. This is counter to our body's survival instinct. The body all by itself hates pain, doesn't need any help from us. The body, we're born into the system that loves pleasure, that craves for pleasure, that lusts after pleasurable experiences. What we do have free will over is our ability to pay attention and eventually our ability to respond when we're paying attention. Without intentionally paying attention to the present moment, we're slaves to the survival instinct. We are asleep. We are being dragged downstream with the rest of the sheep, with the rest of the sleeping masses, waging war against our own pain, lusting after our own pleasurable experiences. Without mindfulness, we're part of the problem in this world. With mindfulness, we have the choice to be part of the solution. With mindfulness, we have the choice to start to transform. Second foundation of mindfulness: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Beginning to learn to tolerate pain. We talk about compassion and compassion. I believe, in my own experience, there's a real middle step. I couldn't go right from "I fucking hate pain" to "I'm totally okay with pain and I meet it with compassion." That's a long commute. And meditation is a way to begin to learn to tolerate just the unpleasant thoughts and feelings, sensations of sitting still. Tolerance on the way to compassion. First, there's learning to tolerate our own pain, to sit in it, before we learn to meet it with love. I mean, of course, we're trying to meet it with compassion. We're trying. My own experience is that I was really trying and failing for a long, long time. But I learned to tolerate it without doing so much pushing away. And to me, that's not necessarily compassion, as in the kind of the antidote to suffering, but it is mercy. And we talked a couple months ago or so about mercy as the definition of mercy of being to stop causing harm where you can stop causing harm. Maybe tolerance isn't the full solution, but at least it's stopping the aversive pushing and hatred of the pain that is going to cause extra suffering. And so in that way, tolerating the pain in the meditation, in the daily life, is a merciful act that's on its way to a wise, compassionate life. It's in the right direction. We talk a lot about, or I talk a lot about, I talk a lot, but I talk a lot about how to respond to pleasure, how to respond to pain. Sometimes I skip over the neutrality. And of course, mindfulness puts us right face to face with our relationship to the neutral moments. Do you see much neutrality in your meditation? You probably just experience it as boredom. Most of us experience it as boredom. Part of what mindfulness will begin to show us is how addicted to intensity we are. How easy it is to pay attention when life is intense. Intensely pleasurable, sex, I'm there, paying attention. Mindful, I'm concentrated. Paying attention. Intensely painful, I'm there, focused. Okay, pain. Neutral, daydreaming. Either daydreaming or even in the subtle ways in meditation. When does your mind wander? Often, it's those neutral moments. I began to realize for myself on retreat that the place where my mind would wander most often is the pause between the in-breath and the out-breath. Breathing in, there's just a little pause and gone. Because it wasn't so neutral. Not much feeling to it. Wasn't pleasant, wasn't unpleasant. My mind lost interest. Got some planning to do. Not only do we have to learn to tolerate pain, we have to learn to tolerate neutrality. And I say have to. You don't have to do anything. But of course we're talking about what's going to end our suffering and bring a greater sense of happiness and contentment and well-being according to the Buddha. To live in harmony with neutrality. But also, we're not trying to get rid of pleasure and pain. We're just trying to change our relationship to them. Pain's not going anywhere. That's the bad news. You can get fully enlightened and you will still hurt. pleasure's not going anywhere either. That's the bad news. It's a given. These bodies are just sensitive. They feel pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. They're just built that way. Pain's never the, as I said in the meditation, it's never what's happening that's the problem. It's always how we're relating to what's happening that's the problem. But this is a very different way of seeing, isn't it? Aren't you used to blaming? I would be happy if fucking helicopters are disturbing my meditation. These guys weren't in my way. I could park out here, then I'd be happy. It's not my aversion to what's happening. No. It's what's happening. They're in my way. They're disturbing me. Mindfulness asks us to take 100% responsibility for how we're responding to what's happening. How we are relating to the reality of our present moment experience. The third foundation, bring attention to the impermanent, impersonal process of your mind itself. The process. Thoughts are arising and passing. It's hard to do. Third foundation is a little bit advanced practice. To have enough stability, enough concentration, to be mindful of thoughts arising and passing, and to be able to have a stability to observe your mind without getting drawn off into the plans, without getting identified and drawn off into the memories. But there is a stability that will come in our mindfulness practice where you'll be able to just be grounded here, present, observing the arising and passing of thought. Seeing for yourself that the mind has a mind of its own, thoughts, and there is no thinker. It's just the brain spinning its program. Desires, aversions, judgments, creative projects, just the brain doing its dance. Watch it. And this is so liberating when we can start to break our, not only our addiction to intensity, I need it to be hardcore. I wasn't looking for peaceful serenity, I was looking for intense serenity. I wasn't looking for a calm happiness, I was looking for a extreme peace and quiet. So not only do we break our addiction to the intensity, but also our addiction to the mind, our identification with the mind, our addiction to thinking. Not that we stop thinking ever, but taking it personal and believing everything that the mind says. It is so liberating to have the experience of relating to your mind with mindfulness, rather than from it, rather than believing it, rather than incarnating as every single thought that comes to mind. Like a, I don't know what. But just taking everything personal. One teacher said, mindfulness shows you, of your thoughts, shows you who you aren't. Most of our lives, we're taking our thoughts to be who we are. I am the contents of my mind. We never say that, I am the contents of my mind, but we act like that. We believe that deep down. I am what I think. I think, therefore I am. I am what I think. Mindfulness begins to show us good news, people. I am not this fucking mind. Thank God. My father used to say, anybody here be willing to put on a helmet that broadcast your thoughts? No. Anybody? I'm a piece of shit. She's a piece of shit. This guy's stupid. Right? Whatever your mind is doing. I really like the way he's meditating tonight. I wonder if he's single. Just whatever you're like. Wait a minute, I wasn't thinking that. Who said that? Just the mind doing its dance. Fourth foundation I pointed to in the meditation instructions tonight. The first piece of the, I know this is a lot of numbers, but the first, one of the first practices of the fourth foundation of mindfulness is to bring mindfulness to the first noble truth. Are you suffering? Are you unhappy, dissatisfied, stressed out right now? Bring mindfulness directly to the experience of dukkha, stress, unhappiness, suffering. Pay attention to it. And to the second truth, what's causing it? And to the moments of the third truth of nibbana, the extinguishing of the suffering, when you let go of the craving, when you meet the pain with tolerance or compassion. Pay attention to those little moments of freedom, mindfulness, of the four noble truths. The first noble truth is not a philosophy. It is a task to know fully the nature of your suffering. It's not this, as it often likes to get translated, the Buddha said, life is suffering. No, he said, you want to be happy? Know fully the nature of your dissatisfaction or suffering. Through mindfulness, know it fully. Second noble truth, not a philosophy, task. Your suffering is being caused through attachment or aversion. Let go. The second noble truth is not a philosophy, it is a meditation instruction. Let go of craving, of clinging, of aversion. Release the cause of your suffering. Easier said than done, but at least try. At least try to let go. Just try. The fourth foundation goes on to the five hindrances. Is there craving? Is there aversion? Is there restlessness? Is there sleepiness? Or is there doubt? The first four are manageable. We all experience craving, aversion. We all experience restlessness, sloth, torpor. The fifth one is considered the hardest to deal with, the most debilitating and dangerous hindrance, doubt. Because doubt has the power to stop your practice. If doubt is powerful enough, if we believe it, if we incarnate as it, we take it personal, we believe the doubt will stop meditating. As long as the confidence and the practice continues, then you can deal with the craving, with the aversion, with the restlessness, with the sleepiness. But if the doubt gets overwhelming, you won't get on the cushion anymore. You won't bring mindfulness to your activities anymore. You'll say, oh, this shit's not possible. Or, it's possible, but I'm just too fucked up. I can't do it. Other people could do it, but not me. That kind of self-doubt. Or doubt in the path itself. This Buddhist stuff doesn't work. I'm going back to church. These are some of my thoughts on mindfulness practice, on the four foundations, as a path, fully encompassing path that leads to full liberation, full freedom, happiness. If you're the first time you're hearing this stuff, it's a little complicated, but if you've heard this stuff a few times, you get it. It's actually fairly straightforward. Just pay attention to the present. All of the different levels of the present in the body. This is where Buddhism is really different. It's not about transcending or getting rid of the body. It's the body itself is our practice, is our path. Pay attention to your body. All of the Dharma will be revealed in this body. A lot of practices treat the body like, and even Buddhist practices sometimes in a confused way, treat the body like it's the problem. The Buddha was clear, the body is the path to your salvation. Everything that you're looking for, the happiness, the transformation, has to take place in this body. How we're relating to this body. Ashley, yeah, please.
If doubt's the big bad, what's the solution?
What'd you say, doubt?
Yeah, doubt's the big thing to watch out for. Mm-hmm. How do you treat doubt? How do you respond to doubt?
Couple of ways. One is through mindfulness, if you can begin to see doubt and all of these hindrances, like everything else that arises, just a thought. A doubting thought is no really different than a planning thought. If you can relate to it in mindfulness, oh, I'm planning again. Oh, doubting again. Oh, remembering again. Desire again, doubting again. So when you just start relating to your mind and the different contents that arise, if you can bring doubt as just another sort of big surprise, of course doubt arises in my mind. Not take it so personal. Now that's the problem. Doubt is not a problem at all. It's the belief in the doubt. It's the identification. It's, we could say, incarnating, taking birth as that. Then you're fucked. No. Then what do? It happens, right? It happens to all of us. We experience it. We take it personal. Try to replace it. The Buddha talks about the different efforts of something really unwholesome, like a doubt is considered a kind of... Now, it's tricky. We're talking about it, I feel like it's tricky, because not all... questioning is doubt. There is some healthy place of skepticism and of questioning and of... So it becomes tricky. But one of the ways is to try to bring to mind the confidence that you used to have. If you had some confidence, if you had some faith, say, if we're talking about the Dharma, at one point, you were really sure that this was a good thing to do. You started, you were inspired by the book, by the teacher, by whatever it was, and you had faith. And so when doubt has overwhelmed you, trying to reflect back on, I used to know that this was a good idea and that I had the capacity to do it. Right now, I'm forgetting. But trying to replace it, to go back to that. If that doesn't work, sometimes it's just patience. The doubt will pass. It's impermanent, like everything else. You can just let it come and let it go. A couple of ways to work with it. Of course we're going to get stuck in doubt sometimes. Anything else about how to apply mindfulness? Does this all make sense? Clear enough? Yeah, please.
It seems like for doubt to be a negative thing, it has to be founded in delusion. If it's a healthy doubt, I don't mean to go there, but if it's a healthy doubt, it's a positive thing.
Yeah, so if it's ever about your capacity, then it's unhealthy. If that's the sort of... Yeah, they're delusional. Yeah, if it's the sort of low self-esteem, self-worth kind of doubt, then that's just delusional, like you're saying. You are worthy, you do have the capacity, it's just your conditioned mind that is trying to convince you otherwise. Carol?
If there's just earth, air, fire, water, what is consciousness or awareness?
Byproduct of these four elements coming together in this human form.
It's just really hard to distill it down to that level.
And what's most important...
the difference between a dead being and a alive being?
Yeah.
Then there's none. Right?
Well, there might be. Certainly the fire element will be missing when your body is a corpse. But rather than intellectualizing an answer, investigate it. Investigate it. Be mindful of the... pay attention to consciousness. Closely investigate consciousness. What is it? Without coming up with an answer, be mindful of it. Turn your attention on consciousness itself. What element is it? Like that, so that you don't... so that we're not trying to think our way to the answers of this stuff, but find out, you know, just look carefully at it. And... it will be revealed, it seems like. I mean, I don't really know the answer. Byproduct is the answer, but pay attention to the byproduct. Maybe that's enough. Last question, Todd.
The other day I wanted to sort of practice mindfulness while I was doing some sites and meditating.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really hard. Like, I picked something kind of neutral, like I would wash the dishes and try and be mindful. And I found, like, not... my mind was so used to going to the breath, but then the more I focused on my breath, I wasn't really paying attention to doing a good job of the dishes. Is it just a matter of practice?
I mean, in that, it's like walking meditation. When sitting, often breath is the anchor, and then in walking, your attention's more in your footsteps. In the washing, like sometimes on retreat, I like to do the washing of the pots and pans, and I bring most of my attention into my hands, feeling the suds, feeling the water. Let go of the breath completely. You don't need to be with the breath and the washing. Let the breath be background, and just the friction, the rubbing, the soapiness, the scrubbing. That's the focus then. Full mindfulness of movement, of water, of contact with the dish. Shift your awareness to that. Good. Thank you so much for your attendance and your practice here tonight. Ultimately, find out for yourself, right? Here's a lot of teaching, philosophy. This stuff is pretty close to how we understand the original teachings to be, how the Buddha encouraged it. But ultimately, find out. Put it into application. Don't believe this stuff. It's not philosophy. It's action. Be mindful and see the results for yourself.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.